Hey everyone, I'm Sam.
And I'm Sean.
And this is Key to the Case. Welcome back. Thank you all so much for tuning in today. I have a special episode to bring you. A man named James reached out to us earlier this year and told us that in 1983, he and his girlfriend, Catherine Britt, were attacked. Catherine, who went by Kathy, did not survive the assault while James did. It's 43 years later, and the case is still unsolved. So James is looking to get more attention and more eyes on the case. I was very fortunate to get to ask James a lot of questions that we otherwise wouldn't have had the answers to. He's in this very unique, albeit tragic, position of seeing the person who killed his girlfriend. That is not something we come across every day. So we greatly appreciate James reaching out and bringing this to our attention. I had not heard of this case before, and it may be the first time many of you are hearing it. So please spread the word, share this episode. It's a small action you can take that can make a big difference. All right, let's get into it. Kathy Britt was 22 years old at the time of her murder in 1983. Kathy spent most of her life in Maryland, where she was raised alongside a brother and sister. She attended high school in Bel Air, Maryland, where she met James, who was 1 year older than her. Kathy and James began dating, and James shared that no one ever had a bad word to say about Kathy. She was a rather likable person. He even described her as one of the friendliest, warmest, and nicest people you could meet. Kathy was devoted and loyal to her family and friends, and once she met James, he felt that devotion as well in their relationship. Kathy was quick-witted and highly intelligent, qualities that certainly contributed to her academic success and earned her a place in the top 10% of her graduating class. I found another common theme with Kathy, and that was her consideration for others. She was always thinking of other people, so it was no surprise when James shared that Kathy would watch him play in basketball games, and during a big tournament, she tracked all of his statistics and shared them with him after the games. Kathy was an athlete herself, something that brought her and James closer. Kathy loved sports, but tennis was really her sport of choice. Accomplished tennis player, she also enjoyed racquetball, basketball, and flag football, but at times she had jobs teaching tennis, oftentimes teaching children tennis, and the kids she worked with always enjoyed having her as their teacher. James shared that some of his favorite memories with Kathy involved visiting her on Maryland's Eastern Shore, where her family moved in early 1980, not long after Kathy graduated from high school. He would spend a few days with her, and because her family lived on the water, they would head out early in the morning to catch crabs. He also remembered taking long bike rides through the scenic shore and enjoying dinners out with her. And you have to think all of this was happening in the 70s and 80s, but the way James described it sounded so fresh. It kind of goes to show how much those visits meant to him. After graduating from high school, Kathy enrolled at Towson State University, now known as Towson University, just north of Baltimore. James initially attended a local community college before transferring to Towson as well. Kathy was a dual major in economics and geography, and her academic success continued in college, where she once again proved to be a top student. Newspaper articles about this case from when it happened reported that Kathy already had a banking job lined up post-graduation. At the time of her murder in May 1983, Kathy and her younger sister, Karen, shared an apartment in Cockeysville, Maryland, a suburb not far from the university. On the other hand, James was living at home. His father had passed away a few years prior in 1980. And if I haven't mentioned it already, he was 1 year older than Kathy. So he graduated from Towson the year before with a sports management degree. James worked as the program director of the Bel Air Athletic Club. So much of his time was spent there, both for work and weightlifting or teaching racquetball. 1 week before the murder, Kathy and James met up to train for an upcoming race that Kathy was planning to partake in Baltimore. At that time, they planned to meet the following week on May 14th. Before we get into the events of May 14th and beyond, it was upsetting to think about the future that was ripped away from Kathy and James. They'd been together since high school, and now Kathy was about to graduate from college, and their relationship had endured that period. Everything pointed toward a bright future, and had Kathy's life not been taken, she and James appeared destined to continue building their lives together, and Kathy building her own life. On Saturday, May 14th, 1983, Kathy and James went on what seemed like a routine date. Dinner, followed by a showing of the movie Breathless, starring Richard Gere. Now, afterward, they returned to Kathy's apartment, where they watched the Baltimore Orioles play against the Texas Rangers. They decided to head back out to spend some quiet time alone. Since Kathy lived with her sister and James lived with his family, opportunities to be by themselves were likely few and far between. Their destination was the Loch Raven watershed area. This location was just a few miles from Kathy's apartment, and couples were known to sometimes visit this area because it offered privacy. It's a pretty heavily wooded area. In fact, where Kathy and James went near the intersection of Poplar Hill Road and Merriman's Mill Road, it was later referred to as a lover's lane. This area is around Loch Raven Reservoir. Specifically, where Kathy and James were was a little bit north of the reservoir.
Was this somewhere that they had been before?
I asked James if he and Kathy had been to this Loch Raven area before, and he indicated that they'd never been there late at night together, but James clarified that they were familiar with the area considering Kathy lived nearby and James had to sometimes drive through that area to get to her apartment. But to be clear, this was not somewhere they frequented at night. According to reporting from the Evening Sun, James and Kathy got there around 1 a.m. in James's car. About half an hour later, James and Kathy heard a car zip around the corner at a high rate of speed, and this certainly got their attention, but they didn't see anything other than the car's taillights. Then, about 30 minutes after that, around 2 a.m., Kathy and James prepared to leave the area when, truly, out of nowhere, a man silently approached the vehicle, but in the darkness, they didn't see him approach the car, nor did they see another car park near them. Instead, they were ambushed by a man firing a gun directly into the passenger side window, completely blowing it out. He proceeded to fire into the vehicle through that window five more times, making that a total of six rounds. During the shooting, Kathy was shot three times in the head, and James was shot three times, once in the head, chest, and arm. The bullet that initially entered his right arm ended up in his left arm. The perpetrator then demanded that James give him his wallet, and he handed it over with what little cash was inside.
I mean, if a robbery was the ultimate end goal here, the sequence of events seems a bit backwards to me. When did you demand the wallet first before shooting them three times each?
Right. And he didn't have to shoot them if what he wanted was to rob them. He didn't announce himself, make himself known as he approached the vehicle. I think it was a complete afterthought. It truly seems this shooter's primary objective was violence, likely with the intent of killing Kathy and James. The demand for James's wallet does not feel like the true motive in this case. If robbery had been the goal, the shooter could have simply approached the car, displayed a firearm, and demanded the wallet or whatever valuables they might have. Instead, he fired 6 shots into the vehicle before ever asking for it, before speaking a word at all. That level of violence seems inconsistent with a robbery as the primary motive. And James, as well as the police, agree with this notion.
So you said at the beginning that James saw this guy. I assume the guy wasn't wearing anything to conceal his face whatsoever.
Right. He was unmasked, which was a choice on his part. What do you think about that?
Yeah. I mean, I suppose it's the middle of the night. So maybe this guy didn't think he needed to wear a mask, especially with the end goal of going up to the car and shooting these people right away. He probably figured that he wouldn't need to cover up his face because he assumed these people would be dead.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I typically think when I hear that a suspect doesn't wear a mask. They're probably thinking their victims are not going to make it out alive. But like you said, there's also the possibility that he thought he was just concealed by the darkness and that, you know, it all happened so fast, or he just didn't think everything through.
So once he got the wallet, did he just walked away? At that point, he must have realized that James was still alive. Maybe he assumed he wasn't going to make it.
I would assume that's what he assumed, yes.
So he didn't fire any more shots after that?
No. Something kind of conflicting, though, with not wearing a mask is that he only spoke a few words. It kind of gives the opposite impression of not wearing a mask, as if he didn't want his voice to be identified later. But maybe he just didn't feel a need to say much during this crime. I don't know. It's just very unsettling that the shooter didn't care about shooting directly into the glass and how that could ricochet back on him or obstruct his view. He just went straight into this surprise attack. And yeah, after obtaining the wallet, he fled. Now, James did not hear or see a vehicle take off. So that tells us the suspect either parked a distance away or walked, or I suppose had a relatively quiet car. And when I say walked, I mean maybe he lived in the area and just walked up to their car from wherever he lived. Pretty astonishingly, after being shot 3 times, James managed to drive away from the scene and back to Kathy's apartment complex to seek help. James leapt out of his car and frantically pressed every apartment buzzer he could reach until someone called for help. He told a resident who came outside to assist them that someone had shot them. And not long after, emergency services arrived and rushed Kathy and James to the University of Maryland Medical Center. James tried to provide as much information as he could, but he began to hemorrhage. And at that point, what mattered was getting James and Kathy the critical care they needed, and the information transfer would have to happen later. James underwent surgery for his injuries. Both of his lungs had collapsed, and he had a severed esophagus. But thanks to the medical treatment, he survived, as you've known since the beginning of this story. But even after all he went through, one bullet remained lodged in his chest. Kathy's situation was more bleak. As mentioned, she lost consciousness pretty quickly after being shot in the head 3 times and never regained consciousness. Kathy clung to life for 4 days in a coma, and her family and James remained hopeful during those 4 days. A spokesperson for Kathy's family told the media at the time that they were hoping she would survive down to the last moment. She was taken off the respirator 2 days after the shooting and was breathing on her own until 2 days after that when she succumbed to the injuries. Kathy officially died 4 days after the attack on May 19th, 1983. As I hit on earlier, you know, Kathy was about to graduate. She was on the cusp of a new chapter in life. So the least her university could do was to dedicate a part of the graduation ceremony to her. And she was posthumously granted her degree in geography and economics. And later, a scholarship was started in Kathy's name. The Baltimore County Police led the investigation into this attack and killing, and they certainly had their work cut out for them. But they had the fact that James survived and saw the suspect. He got a good enough look that he was able to give the police a description and work with a sketch artist to develop what James thought was a fairly accurate sketch. The shooter was a white male with a slimmer, medium build, estimated to weigh between 135 and 145 pounds and stood between 5'6 and 5'8. He had stringy brown hair and may have had a small mustache. One of my main takeaways is that, you know, we get these very average descriptions, but as far as the suspect's stature goes, he sounded like he was on the smaller side. And I do think that's helpful information. The sources varied on the estimated age range of the suspect. In some sources, he was placed between 22 and 32, while other sources said he was likely between 28 and 33. So I asked James about this, which, by the way, his memory is remarkable on all of this. But he said that he felt the shooter looked several years older than him, and he was 23 at the time. So he felt like the later 20s, early 30s range felt more accurate. If this killer is still alive, he would probably be in his 70s now. The sketch will be posted on our Instagram page, Key to the Case Podcast. So please head on over there at some point to take a look. And of course, it's a sketch of him at the time. There was a sketch, or maybe a couple of sketches that came out later that were kind of age progressed. But to me, I felt like the first sketch was of the highest quality. The other ones didn't feel as detailed as the first one. Much to the surprise of James, and frankly, most of the community, there had been an eerily similar attack in the Loch Raven watershed area 4 weeks before the attack on Kathy and James. On April 16th, 1983, another couple visited a lover's lane about 2.5 miles or 4 kilometers from where Kathy and James had parked. As was the case with Kathy and James, a man approached their vehicle out of the blue and fired a weapon into the car, this time opening the passenger side door and firing inside. In the case of James and Kathy, he never opened any of the doors. The victims were Ronald and Jill. Ronald was 27 and Jill was 23. Like James, Ronald managed to drive away, but in his desperate attempt to get help, he was actually pulled over for speeding. I can only imagine the shock the patrol officer must have felt when he realized what had happened to the people inside. Despite Jill having been shot in the head, they both survived their injuries.
Was that attack, the one that happened in April, pretty well covered? So, you know, everyone in the community knows what happened, including Kathy and James?
No.
I'm assuming it wasn't, since they voluntarily went to this.
Went out there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, they didn't know about it. And really, it was not well publicized at all. The police explained that they thought the attack on Ronald and Jill was an isolated incident. So they didn't really attempt to get the word out the way they would have if they believed the shooter could strike again. I really don't know what made them believe it was isolated. I mean, to my knowledge, it's not like Ronald and or Jill had anyone after them. So there must have been something we don't know that led them to that conclusion, or it was simply a mistake that they didn't act fast enough and warn people about this. Unfortunately, if Kathy and James had known about the shooting, they likely would have opted not to go out that night in that area. There were a multitude of similarities between the attack of Ronald and Jill in April and the attack of Kathy and James. They were both young couples in their 20s. They were in the same general area late at night. It was dark and rainy both nights. The shooter used a 25 caliber handgun, and the female victims were shot in the head in both instances.
If we're assuming this was the same perpetrator in both of these instances, it's a little surprising that he didn't put on a mask or anything to conceal his face the second time, knowing that Ronald and Jill both lived in the first attack. You would think he would change his approach for the second attack.
That's a good point. Why would he not pivot the second time and be more careful and wear a mask. Unless, now that I'm thinking about it, because this case, Ronald and Jill's attack, didn't get much publicity, maybe he didn't know that they survived. And it did happen pretty close together, right? 4 weeks. So now I'm like, we're assuming he knew, and that makes sense that he would know they didn't survive. But yeah, maybe it was the lack of coverage of their attack that he didn't know. Or again, he's just not thinking things through. When I learned that a 25 caliber handgun was used, I thought way back to the murders of Lisa Guerrieri and Brandon Rumbaugh that were covered back in 2023. It was our 12th episode. And Lisa and Brandon were a young couple shot to death with a 25 caliber handgun while they were camping in the Arizona desert. That case actually has a lot of similarities to today's case. They're very much not connected, but I referenced back to what I researched for that one about the 25 caliber pistol. This handgun is often described as a pocket pistol because it's tiny. It easily fits in the palm of the average adult's hand. This pistol was inexpensive and widely available in the 70s and 80s. They later faded in popularity with the introduction of superior options. And it is a relatively small caliber, so the fact that three of the four victims survived isn't as surprising as it might have been had a larger caliber handgun been used. That said, as this case tragically demonstrates, it's still more than capable of being lethal. Some of the similarities between Ronald and Jill and James and Kathy's cases could be coincidences, while others were likely not. For example, the couples both being in their 20s could be happenstance. Maybe that's the age range of people who would be more likely to be out at that lover's lane. I say this because given how dark it was, it seems unlikely the shooter could have gotten a good look at the occupants of each car before attacking. If the suspect intended to target couples specifically, choosing a lover's lane at that hour would have all but guaranteed he would find them. The police could find no connection between Kathy and James and Ronald and Jill, making them almost certainly targets of circumstance. The police believed they were randomly targeted completely, and James adheres to that theory.
Yeah, this guy probably liked the situation that both of them were in. I mean, they're out in the woods, they're isolated, there's a very low chance that they're going to be able to get help quickly.
Right. It could be that he was choosing situations that he felt gave him an advantage with these crimes.
So did Ronald and Jill see the sketch that came out of James and Kathy's attack?
They did. But from what I could find, they did not get as good of a look at the shooter as James did. It all happened so fast and it was dark, so they couldn't really confirm that their shooter matched the description of James and Kathy's shooter, but it's widely believed that it was the same person. With a pattern beginning to emerge, police made sure to notify the public of the incidents this time. They urged people to stay away from the area and from lovers' lanes in general, until they could determine exactly what had happened and who was behind it. They emphasized this multiple times because they said some couples weren't heeding their advice. They were still finding couples in the area late at night. 1 month after Kathy and James were attacked, in an effort to catch the shooter, the police placed bait cars in several secluded locations near where they had been attacked. They used sporty-looking cars with mannequins occupying the seats while tactical SWAT teams waited nearby in the woods. Some men who had been out drinking stopped at one of the cars to warn the passengers inside as they had heard about the shootings. But that was the only action around the car that night. James indicated that they wanted to set this up in June, 4 weeks after they were attacked, because Ronald and Jill had been attacked 4 weeks before that. So there was the theory that the shooter was operating monthly. The police then repeated the operation several times, including on the anniversaries of the shootings, but it never produced any leads. The police were also on the lookout for leads regarding incidents 6 to 12 months before the attacks. They felt there was a high likelihood that the shooter harassed people in the Lock Raven area during that period. Now, before the attacks, they didn't have reports of harassment, but there were some instances where people were parked in the area when a car pulled up near their car, stayed momentarily, and then sped off. Definitely strange behavior on that car's part. And I don't know if the description of the car when this was happening was the same among the witnesses, but of course, you begin to think, was that the suspect considering attacking and then getting cold feet, deciding not to for some reason? Who knows at this point, but the police were looking for more. Based on psychological profiles of people who commit this type of crime, they theorized that the suspect may have approached a vehicle, tapped on the window with a flashlight, and reprimanded the women for being out at that hour, perhaps while posing as a figure of authority. Investigators believed he derived satisfaction from projecting an air of authority. And if anyone came forward stating that this was happening before the attacks, there was no mention of it that I could find. And I find this interesting because that's not what the shooter did in the case of Ronald and Jill and Kathy and James. So I just thought it was interesting that they're kind of following that line of thinking of he was pretending to be of authority when we know that isn't what happened necessarily in these two cases. Along those lines, over time, the investigators have revealed their opinions and theories about the shooter. One being that his fury was directed at women. In both shootings, we know the female victims received the brunt of the attack. They theorized that this was not by coincidence and even suggested that in the shooting of Kathy and James, all shots may have been intended for Kathy. If you think about where the shooter was positioned, he was approaching the passenger side of cars. Was that intentional because he thought it was more likely that these women would be on the passenger side, or was there some other reason? Logically, you'd think he'd go to the driver's side first to incapacitate the person who could take off in the car more easily first, and where it might be more likely the male passenger would be. Police theorized that the shooter may have been jealous of the couples who frequented lovers' lanes, believing he was unable to experience that kind of connection himself for some reason. This type of theory doesn't come up often. We don't talk about a lot of couples being targeted like this, but many cases aren't random like this. So when the police are saying this is random, we don't think the victims were specifically targeted, theories like this begin to fit into the picture a bit more. When I asked James about the theory that the women and the attacks were the main targets, he felt like it made a lot of sense. Additionally, investigators believe the shooter is familiar with the Lock Raven area. They theorized he was comfortable moving through the area without attracting attention and may have had family, friends, or some other connection there that made him feel at home. I found some of the shooter's actions to be contradictory. On one hand, this all felt planned and measured. On the other, it felt impulsive, and he seemed tolerant and comfortable with some uncertainty. He couldn't have predicted who would be in the car, that they didn't have their own gun, that no other cars would drive by during the attack, or that no one would see his car if he drove there, or that his gun would kill them, yet he proceeded anyway. It's almost as though he felt the environment he was in, like we talked about, gave him enough of an upper hand to commit this crime with all of that uncertainty, or his compulsion to do this simply outweighed any risk for him. About a month after Kathy and James were attacked, a 27-year-old man from Bel Air, the same town Kathy and James were from, and where James still lived, confessed to a priest and attorney that he was responsible for both shootings. James did not know this man, and shortly after he confessed, the man vanished for several days until June 12th, 1983. On this day, James learned that the man had been found in the basement of his Bel Air home, deceased. He died by strangling himself. He was in his house, which, according to authorities, had already been searched. James still can't understand how he was missed inside the house the first time it was searched, because it later came out that he died this way shortly after he confessed. We don't know why it took a subsequent search to find this individual. The papers from the time stated he lived with his mother, too, making this detail even more confounding. James described the situation as very unnerving. The man was taken to the morgue in Baltimore. James explained that the city's morgue was the only facility in Maryland equipped to handle cases like this. Any body that could potentially be connected to a crime was transported there to ensure forensic evidence was properly preserved should further investigation become necessary.
So was James able to get a look at this guy?
So the police actually asked him to go to the morgue and view the man's body. And just think about that. First, he lost his girlfriend and sustained major injuries that he was recovering from. Then he finds out that someone from his hometown confessed to doing it. Then he finds out that man died by suicide, and now he's being asked to view the body to see if he could identify him as the shooter. And that's a lot. James talked about how he had been a part of a couple of traditional viewings when his father and grandfathers died, which is already a difficult experience. But to have to see a deceased person under these circumstances is unlike any other experience. So he was on edge, but agreed to view the man's body. Keep in mind that the man was found after he'd been dead for a few days. So decomposition was already in progress. And considering he died by strangling himself, this man was in an altered condition. However, when James examined his face, he felt he strongly resembled the shooter. He told the investigators that he couldn't be 100% certain that it was him, but if they could find some evidence to connect him to their case, he would feel confident that this man was the responsible party. And I think this is significant because, with everything considered, the man's condition when James viewed his body, as well as the brief period in which James saw the shooter, the darkness of the night of the attack, and the fact that it was a highly traumatic event, all of that could make it harder to make an identification. And he didn't make an identification, but said there were a lot of similarities. I imagine there was this feeling of pressure, knowing he was the only person in that situation who could identify the shooter. So I actually think that restraint arguably makes his feeling more significant, because he resisted any pressure to provide certainty where he didn't have it. Despite this, the police indicated publicly that they didn't believe this man was the shooter. They thought he falsely confessed. They claimed they were able to place him elsewhere at the time of the attack on Kathy and James, but did not clarify where they believed him to be. Additionally, they couldn't find a .25 caliber handgun in his possession. That doesn't mean much, because he could have easily gotten rid of that gun in the month after James and Kathy's attack, or even concealed it somewhere that was not searched. This was kind of a theme with the police in this case that I thought was odd. They said sometimes they'd find a person who seemed like a good suspect, and that suspect owned a lot of guns, but not a .25 caliber handgun, as if that is information that would exclude someone from the suspect pool. Surely they weren't using that to fully rule people out, especially like years after the crimes. Back to the man who confessed, they said his alleged mental health struggles were another reason they didn't think he was responsible. I'm not entirely sure what that means. It seems like they were implying he may not have been fully capable of pulling these attacks off because of that. But everything they've shared doesn't seem like the strongest evidence to conclusively exclude him. Sure, there's information they've kept to themselves, though. I guess the strongest would be if they truly could place him somewhere else conclusively on the nights of the attacks, but I don't know where they were placing him in those early morning hours, a whole month after the attack of Kathy and James, unless he was somewhere that had documentation of him being there, like jail or a mental health facility, somewhere like that. The police ultimately couldn't find evidence to link him to the attacks, but they also haven't seemed to have found evidence to connect anyone to these cases. Surprisingly, there was another individual who claimed responsibility for the shootings, who also died by suicide shortly after Kathy's murder. The police didn't know about the second man who confessed until 1990, 7 years after Kathy was murdered. In 1983, this man lived near where the shootings occurred, matched the description of the suspect, and had a history of mental health conditions. The details on this man are sparser, and his family denied his involvement. When this information came out, the investigators stated they couldn't rule this individual out, but the police weren't able to question him about the cases since they found out after he died by suicide. So at least one of the two men falsely confessed. It's possible they both did. Why would they do that completely unprompted? We don't know, but it likely had something to do with the state of their mental health at the time. And I say unprompted because we tend to hear of false confessions after extremely intense police interrogations, but that was not the case here. I have a lot of doubts about the first person being pretty much ruled out, it sounded like to me. The second suspect, it sounds like they were not as confident about ruling out, but we also know less about him. I don't know. I'm just like, someone confessing to a crime, yes, you do have false confessions. They happen more than you would think, but not as often in this manner where, like I said, they're just completely unprompted or they completely came out of nowhere. Sometimes you hear about false confessions where someone is wanting to take credit for a crime. If they're involved in a lot of crime, right? It's pretty sick, but they think it can create some sort of intimidation around them. But yeah, I just didn't get that impression in this case.
Yeah, it seems like one of them's lying. Potentially, unless they were working together, which I don't know if they mentioned that, they said, you know, I committed this crime with the help of this other guy. I doubt they said that.
Yeah, I don't think that was part of either of their confessions. It sounded like they were taking sole responsibility, each individually taking sole responsibility. In 1991, the Evening Sun reported that police were focusing on five suspects, none of whom had known histories of homicide. However, it appears investigators never gathered enough evidence to build a case against any of them. Interestingly, after Kathy and James were attacked, there were no similar incidents. So the pattern stopped for a reason or multiple reasons. Could it be that they stopped because the shooter died? The men who confessed died pretty quickly after, so it would make sense that they stopped if either of them committed the crimes, but there could be other reasons. He could have moved to some other location, could have been incarcerated for some other crime, or lost the desire to commit these acts, among other possibilities. There was another person of interest who came up. James shared that in the 2010s, he received an out-of-state call from a man who had attended high school near the Loch Raven watershed area. He told James that after a high school reunion, another man showed him a gun and said something to the effect of, "Remember what happened in 1983? This was the gun I used." This, of course, alarmed the other man, so he contacted the police with this information. And when he reached out to James, he told him that the police didn't really take him seriously, and that's why he was contacting him directly. When James spoke with the county police about this, they confirmed that they had received the tip, but had been able to rule the man out who made the statement. And I asked how they were able to rule him out, and he said that there were a few reasons. One being that the gun this individual showed to the other person was not the same type of weapon used in their attacks. He also did not look like the sketch did not look like the man James saw. And he said that he saw a photograph of this man, and of all of the photos he had seen over the years or of the people who had confessed, this man looked the least like the shooter. It was a photo from years later, but still, he didn't see much of a resemblance there. That man was also dead by that point. He was killed by a gunshot during an argument. Seems like it would be harder to rule someone out completely after they have passed, but again, with those details I shared, they were comfortable saying this was not their shooter.
When he said that, was he explicitly referencing the attack on James and Kathy? Because he said something like what happened in 83. I mean, that's pretty broad.
Yeah, I had that thought too. He could have been talking about something else. I don't know if this man went on to explain what he was talking about in 1983, or if he just said that and then the person he said it to made the assumption that that's what he was talking about because it was, you know, well known at that point about what had happened in the Lochraven area. And it's not like there were crimes like that happening all the time, right? So could have been that there was a little piecing two and two together going on there. There's one more detail to discuss here, a detail I don't think has been reported anywhere publicly in regards to this case. In the fall of 1983, James came home to this thick envelope in the mail. He was surprised to find that the envelope contained the contents of his stolen wallet. James said he could not be 100% certain that everything that had been in his wallet previously was there in the envelope, but it seemed like most of it. The envelope also enclosed a letter from the person who mailed it to James saying that they found his wallet, or possibly just the contents of the wallet, while hiking in the Lochraven watershed. James, of course, reported this to the police and handed over for review. It doesn't seem like anything ultimately came of this, but it was shocking and leads to more questions. Did the killer take what little cash James had and then throw the wallet out the window into the woods because it had no value to him at that point? I'd like to know how far from a road this hiker was, because if they were a good distance away, then the killer would have had to leave the contents there on foot. And that would make me think this person was pretty familiar with that area.
Yeah, that'd be pretty bold if it was the killer who sent it, especially if there was like a return address on the envelope. I don't know if you mentioned that, but
I don't think there was a return address. No, I tend to think that this was from a hiker. If the killer did hold on to his items and then mail them back, I just feel like the letter would be a little bit different, because if you're going to these lengths to do that, it feels like you want to taunt James in some way or just make yourself known a little bit. And I just think maybe that would have been enclosed in the letter, or maybe there wouldn't have been anything, any note written in the envelope. And there's nothing else about this case that leads us to believe that the killer was wanting to get attention like you hear about in some other cases. So I kind of take this at face value that it probably was a hiker who found it and that the shooter just tossed the items there, discarded the items from his wallet, and didn't want to hold on to them. For this case to be solved now, I think we'll need someone to come forward, someone who knows what happened and has withheld that all of these years. The killer may have told someone about what they did. So many years have passed, I feel that's quite possible. The shooter could be deceased, but either way, he needs to be identified. If someone out there has been holding on to this information for a long time in order to protect the suspect, it's been long enough. So if you have information related to this case or Ronald and Jill's case, please contact the Baltimore County Police at 410-887-3943. Thank you all for tuning in to this special episode. And thank you so much to James for his time and collaboration. He really made our coverage of these cases possible. He's working on a memoir, so I hope that's been a healing process for him and look forward to hearing more about that. That is all for now, but we will be back soon with a new case. Bye.
Bye.